Good evening, everybody. Hello. And welcome back to the world of Kabbalah, lesson 3, the infinite light. I'm delighted to be back together with you. Flew back from New York today, this morning, arrived this afternoon. I had breakfast with my mother today before we left, before I left at about 8 o'clock.
How is your mother?
She's doing well, thank God. Thanks for asking. That was at 8 o'clock. At 8:20, I left to LaGuardia. My flight was at 10 o'clock. And delighted to be back in peace, reinvigorated, rejuvenated, and re-chabadinated too. So, as we have done, until we hear the wonderful news of all the hostages being released, we're going to continue to pray for them always, but especially when we gather together as a group of Jewish people. So I'm going to open by reciting a chapter of Psalms. This is chapter 122. I'll recite it in Hebrew. Shira malis le David samachti ba'imrim li beis adinoi nelech oim desayi raglenu b'shirayich yerushalayim yerushalayim habnuya Keir Shechubra Lo Yachtov, Shesham Alu Shvatim Shifte Yaidis Yisrael, the Hodis Hashem Adonai, Kishama Yashvu, His Ois, the Mishpat, Kis Ois, the Beis David, Sha'alu Shloim Yerushalayim, Mishloyo Yavoyach, Yehi Shalim Bechelech, Shavab Amr Nesoyach, Amanach Evreya Dabran, the Shalim Bachelam Besad Neelahenu, Avaksha Toiv Loch. I'm just going to grab a water bottle, which I didn't do yet, but this trip to New York was not different than all the other ones, where I do not fail to come back with something. So if it sounds like I'm getting over something, it's because I'm getting over something. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Shehakol Nehyeh B'Dvarai.
Amen.
And it is a little intense over there, you know. It's a city that never sleeps. And like I said, it's long days and long nights. And then we start all over again. But it's all worthwhile. I had all of you in mind when I prayed at the Rebbe's gravesite over the weekend. The entire conference was there together on Friday morning. And actually tonight, maybe even as we speak here tonight, right now, there are a chartered plane of 250 family members of the hostage families got onto a chartered plane from Israel. And their first stop is the Rebbe's resting place. I think they're there as we speak tonight. And they're going to be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow as well. Led by the Chabad leadership from the Holy Land in Israel. This chartered flight. So they're there now. And all of you were with me in spirit when I was there. So hopefully all of our prayers will be answered very, very soon and completely. And only blessings and good tidings and happy tidings for everybody. All right, so it's time to get down to business. Today, we have a super exciting class. I know I say this before every class, but I also say before every class, by this class, I really mean it. And that's no different to tonight's. Hello, hello, great to see you. So, we're going to be talking about a few things today. We're going to talk a little bit about angels, a little bit about prayer. We'll talk about marriage. Angels, prayer, marriage, how do all these things come together? But all of these are all going to be in the context of the infinite light. Thank you, Jacob, for handling the door while I'm busy. So, all these topics we're going to be discussing are in the context of lesson 3, which is the infinite light. But before we actually jump into that, I'm just going to give a brief summary of the last two classes, just to make sure that we are all on the same page. And I know the classes themselves were 90 minutes each, but I'm going to try to do it in 90 seconds each. So, just like when you build a house, hello, Nanette. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome back. When you build a house or you build a skyscraper, where do you start?
The
From the top or the bottom? From the bottom. So, as you know from the map that you've been looking at throughout this course, we started our building from the bottom. We started our building from the bottom in lesson one, and we talked about the three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. The key point to remember from this class and about those three worlds, which are on the bottom of left side of your map, the key factor is that these three worlds are the beginning of otherness. God wanted a relationship, and you can't be in a relationship with yourself. You need another in order to be in a relationship. So God created this reality from the world of Bria and down, which, and in Bria, that's where the initiation of otherness is. That's where it starts. And those were those three worlds, and within our human condition, we said that those three things represent the garments of the soul of thought, speech, and action, because that's where there's otherness. Garments are separate. We wear our clothes outside of ourselves. It's not us. Similarly, these three worlds is not God. It's outside of Him. That was class number one. We also talked about how garments of the soul, things that happen in thought, speech, and action, don't define us. And at the same time, we can also, our soul could be in a certain condition, but our garments could do something totally different for the good and for not. But we're not going to get heavy in it. Reminder to please turn phones off.
This is my Libra 2. I have hypoglycemia.
No problem. No problem. Thank you. Thank you. So that's lesson number one. And then we went on to lesson number two, where we moved upward. From the bottom, we continued on to the world of Atzilut, which we talked about last week, which consists of all of these 10 sefirot, as we called them. These 10 emanations. And we used the parable of Newton or Einstein, who is who's giving a lecture. Book?
No, pens.
Okay, if anyone else needs pens or paper, we have them right up here. I know many of you write in your actual book, that's why I didn't put the pads out. But if anyone does need one, right here. And if anyone didn't get a book yet, also I have them up here. So that was lesson one, again, was the worlds of Biyah. Lesson two, we moved up to the world of Atzilut, which consists of 10 sefirot, 10 emanations. And we used a parable to explain emanations, like that professor who has to take his big idea and convey some of it to teenagers. So what does he do? He doesn't come up with a new idea, a different idea to talk about. He actually thinks deep, long and hard, of how to take his big idea, his big theory, and distill it in a way that they could relate to it. And he gives them something. That is the 10 emanations of the world of Atzilut. So it's not something different and new. It's part of the original idea. And that's what this world is. These 10 emanations, which consist of these 10 soul powers, the way they're reflected in the human, these are not outside of the soul. They are the soul. Every one of us have these 10 faculties that define our soul, just like the world of Atzilut is our emanations from God, not separate from Him, but just an emanation from God Himself, something distilled from God. So, that was lesson two. And now, with that, we're going to advance to tonight's topic, which is going to be the infinite light. But before we actually do that, I'm going to ask all of you here, I'm going to say a word, and you tell me what word comes to mind when you hear that word. What does angels mean to you? Give me a word. What do you think of
halos.
When we say angels? What's that?
Halos.
Halos.
Messenger,
nice.
My children.
You must be a Yiddish mama. Okay. Anything else?
Wings.
Wings, very good.
Tough creatures.
Okay, some of them. Anything else?
Caretaker,
okay, yeah. Anyway, all good words. Thank you all. So, there's many worlds, or let's just say, Let's hone in on the worlds that we've been talking about. The three worlds that we spoke about in lesson one. There are a lot of different angels that are stationed in these worlds of Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya. This is where they're primarily stationed. But before that, I want to ask you if this verse sounds familiar to you, maybe from our prayers or otherwise. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. What goes next? Wow, what a great audience. Meloch ala aretz kvodo, right? We say this verse in our prayers. We actually say it every morning, maybe even more than once. And certainly on Shabbat, if you attend services or you're more familiar with Shabbat. And the question is, what do these words mean? So when we say them, as you'll see in text number one, we're actually quoting a verse from Isaiah the prophet. And we repeat these words. But what do they really mean? What's going on when we say these words? What's the context in the prayer when we say these words? Leah, would you like to read for us text number one, please, on page 74 in your book? Seraphim.
The English, right?
Yes, please.
Seraphim stood before above to serve him, six wings to each one, and one called to the other and exclaimed, "Holy, holy, holy is the God of hosts. The entire earth is full of his glory."
Thank you. So we have a few questions here about this verse. Question number one is, why is this passage in our prayers? Why do we say it? If it has anything to do with the angels, fine. But why are we repeating their words? We should say stuff that humans need to say. Why are we saying what the angels say? Number two, why are they called seraphim? Why are these angels getting this title of seraphim? Anyone know what the word seraphim even means? Seraph, serefa, burned. The burned ones. That's what we're calling these angels. Burned beings. What exactly does that mean? Why would we be identifying angels with such a term? And finally, what's the meaning of wings? Why do we describe, as someone mentioned, we associate angels with wings? What's the deal with that? So, to understand it and to appreciate this, we need to talk a little bit first about the topic of tonight's discussion, which is the infinite light. And the infinite light, do you remember last week we had this this exercise of like a black paper with a white paper behind it? Mm-hmm. And the word that we read on it, I believe the word was sephiros, right? So the word was emanating from the white, which was the point that we made with it, but it was coming through the black, which had the letters cut out, but it was really coming from the white. So last week's topic was that word, or those emanations, the way they emerged through the black sheet of paper. Today we're moving backwards. We're going to the backdrop. Today we're going to talk about the white sheet of paper that was behind the black. And that is what we're identifying and calling the infinite light. That's what we're talking about tonight. Now, when we say the infinite light, when we say the infinite light, two things are being implied immediately. Okay? When we say light, when you identify light, what does that immediately tell you? That what is there besides the light?
Dark.
But right now it's light. While it's light, what does light tell you? It's an indication that there is a source to the light. If we see light, then we know for certain that there's also a source where the light's coming from. If we see light, it means there's an illuminator. Hi, Zelina. So there's an illuminator and source where the light's coming from. That's what light immediately tells you. Okay, when you see sunlight, you know there's a sun. When this room is lit up, you know there must be some light bulb somewhere. And that's where the light's coming from. So light means that it indicates that the light itself is not the pinnacle. If there's light As great as the light is, it means that there's still something beyond it. So that's implication number one from the fact that we call the infinite light, light. And the implication number two is that at the same time, when you identify something as light, light is very much connected with its source and is dependent on its source. And therefore, if the source is removed, the light is gone. What happens after sunset? There isn't some light that remains. The sun sets and the light is gone. If I walk over to that switch at the wall and I just push the switch down, I remove the source of light, the light is gone. What about if I walk over to the thermostat and I turn the AC off? I could turn the AC off, but the cool air doesn't vanish immediately. It could stick around for a while. That's still here. Light, however, the moment I remove the source, the light is gone 100%. Or, let's say, rain clouds dissipate. The clouds may dissipate, but the rain that fell is still here. It's not gone when its source is gone. With light, when its source is gone, then the light vanishes immediately. So these two ideas, remember immediately when we talk about light. In Hebrew, by the way, infinite light is Or Ein Sof. Anyone know what Or means?
Light.
Ein Sof. Infinite. That's the word we're going to use. Literally, it means no end, but we're going to be using the word infinite. As a side, as on us side, the reason why it's called no end is because it has no end, but it does have a beginning. It comes from the source. So that's why we say it's Or Ein Sof, but Yesh Lo Tchila, as the Kabbalah teaches. The light does have a beginning. The light comes from the source of the light. But yes, it is infinite in nature. That's why it has no end. And it's infinite, yes.
What about Or Tamid? Isn't that the same?
It's different. Well, Ner Tamid usually is referring to a candle that was lit on the menorah in the temple. So that needed to be serviced. I mean, that's a physical candle. Here we're talking about something spiritual. Spiritual light. Of course, the source of all light in the world eventually, but that's after it goes from the spiritual to the physical. So, what do we say so far? God's infinite self-projection that is intimately connected with God's essence and that transcends definition, limitation, and specific attributes. This is like the definition of this term. The term Or Ein Sof means that exactly what I just read on the screen. That is the infinite light. Now, is that clear so far? Okay, so we said those two points about light, which are kind of two different points. They're differing, but light implies both of them. Okay, on one hand, it's not the top. On the other hand, meaning it tells you that there's something else, number one. Number two, it's very much dependent on that something else. It's very much dependent on its source. In Kabbalah, there's another way of describing, or another term that's used very often, for infinite light. And that is, I guess I've been saying this, that's now on the screen, so we covered that already, but we have another term. And the other term is what you see right here on the screen. It's called Sovev Kol Almin. So divine energy, in this context, has two terms. One is called, let's see, so I used the right words here. So Sovev, anyone know what the word Sovev means? Around, or surround, or encompassing, yes. What do we call something that we spin on Hanukkah? Sivivon, right? We spin it around and around. It's called a Sivivon. Same word, Saviv. This is Sovev. Why do we call this divine energy as if it goes around? Versus the other component or dimension of divine energy, which we call Mimale. So we have Sovev versus Mimale. Mimale comes from the word Male, which means the divine energy that fills the world. In other words, you could have someone, two types of relationships. You can have, let's say, a teacher maybe. One teacher Anyone ever had a teacher who remained very aloof and didn't really engage with the students? Like, if you wanted to talk to him, you had to go over to him and initiate. But he didn't talk to any students on his own. He came in, did his thing, and left. Anyone? Or only my teachers were like that? Maybe. So there's one type that's a more of a Soviet style, just kind of hovering from above, as opposed to Mimale, which is more tailor-made. So within divine energy, you have these two dimensions. You have the dimension that of divine energy that actually enters the world, fills the world, and is like tailored to each aspect within creation. So whatever divine energy that makes generates the rain system, so it's very much tailor-made. So that specific thing should happen successfully. The same is with the sun and the moon and whatever, vegetation. Every aspect of creation has a specific divine energy that's tailor-made to fuel that particular object. That's the memale. That's the second one. It fills all the worlds. God, as he emanates the sephirot and actively creates Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, all the way down to our world, as I was just saying, where it fills all the specifics. But that's that's the engaged teacher who's very involved and he knows what's going on and is aware of every detail and he communicates and he's present, etc. But then you have the aloof approach. I'm going back one slide, and that was Soviv. That's the encompasses all the world. That's a different type of divine energy. That's a divine energy that doesn't get deeply involved. It does vitalize everything about the world and creation, but it does so from a distance. Again, let's not confuse this with meaning physical distance, because it doesn't mean that it stays outside the world physically. It means that this light is too intense from being able to be absorbed internally. So that's why it's, so to speak, it hovers from above. It encompasses. It does its thing from a distance. And it could do its thing to a variety of different aspects, which are very different from each other, but this energy could give life to all those things in the same way. It doesn't need to get involved in the specifics of each one. It does it all in just an encompassing way. However, coming back to the second one, which is Mimale, over there the specifics are very important, because this divine energy has to energize every single component and every single individual. In fact, the Talmud and Kabbalah talk about how every blade of grass has its own divine energy that's making it exist and that's allowing it to grow. Ein lecha esev milmata, she'ein lo mazal milmala, she'makebo ve'omer lo gadel. I'm sorry for the French. But there isn't even one blade of grass that doesn't have its own mazal that is making it grow. That in particular, that is Mimale. That is where every detail gets specific attention. So, what we're focusing on today, though, is the Soviv. Not the Mimale, but the Soviv, because the Soviv, which is the encompassing light, which does its thing more like from a distance, that is what, that's just another term for the infinite light.
And that's what we're experiencing now, right, God?
Well, we're experiencing now that God is, well, that's the way, that's what God wants us to believe. If God was only encompassing us and not filling us, we wouldn't be existing, because every aspect of creation, the way we know it, can't exist without that specific energy. Just like every blade of grass needs it, most certainly all the let's just say the more major things in creation need it. And it's there. But when you look at a blade of grass, you don't see divine energy. You can convince yourself that it's just because it's whatever, it was planted and it was watered and it's all the right things, and that's why it's happening. So yes, God is putting up a very good show and allowing us to believe that his presence and his energy isn't even necessary for nature to do its thing. In fact, even the Sovev, we can think that God is not even doing that. But yes, that's the impression that we get. Someone have a question?
So it's not bifurcated. They work in unison.
These two energies? Yes. Yes, but I think we'll clarify this. It's either the fifth or sixth lesson where we talk about the what's called in Hebrew tzimtzum, which means contraction. And that is the system of how God's infinite light is contracted and condensed to create the memale energy that then is able to relate to everything in a particular way. So yes, it's all part of the same system. It's not two different channels. It's the same thing, but the energy goes through, let's just say, a specific process which allows it to then be able to relate in a more individualized way. You had a question? Okay. So, what did we just do so far? We introduced the idea of light, and we gave it another term called Sovev, which is the all-encompassing divine energy. And with that, we're going to come back to talking about the angels. We asked a question before. What is it? We were wondering, number one, why are angels called burned? Why do they have wings? Why are we reciting things about angels in our prayers? So we'll start to appreciate that a little bit more now. And that is that we said that the angels, largely, they're stationed in those three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, which are outside of God. That's where the angels are. In fact, you may be familiar from our prayers too, before we say these words, what do we say? V'ha'ofanim v'chayot ha'kodesh b'ra'ash gadol mitnasim le'umat hasrafim. How many different angels did I just identify in that line? How many different terms or names for angels?
Four.
Close? Three. There were three different names there. One was Ofanim. Ofanim is a name for one group of angels. I think it means like a wheel, but whatever, not for now. The second one is Chayot HaKodesh, the holy living ones. That's the next term. And the third one was Le'umat HaSrafim. Srafim are also a category of angels. So what exactly are we talking about here? So we said these three terms for angels. That's because in each one of those worlds that you would see on your map of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, in each one of those worlds, there's a different category of angels that hang out there. Right? On the bottom, Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, Ofanim hang out in Asiya. Move up one world to Yetzira, Chayot HaKodesh are based in Yetzira. And the Seraphim, the burned beings, they are hanging out in Bria. If that's the case, then why are they saying, why are these Seraphim in the world of Bria, why are they saying this verse of holy, 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 what is going on? Why are they saying it? So God is present, but that makes the question even stronger. Why are we calling them burned? Burned means when you have a burning desire for something. When you want something really, really badly, you can call that a burning need or a burning desire. So if they already have access to divine presence in that world of Bria, the angels have it, the Seraphim are, like I said, they dwell in Bria. That world is just the very beginning of creation, which means that God's presence is there very much. Maybe even, you could even say, intensely. If that's the case, what are the angels saying? Why do they have a burning desire for godliness if they actually have godliness? If you have a hot sizzling steak sitting in front of you on the table, you're not going to have a deep burning desire for steak. All you have to do is dig in, and you'll be satisfying your desire. Why do they have this burning desire if they already have godliness? And the answer is that because once you have access to a level of godliness and you appreciate it, then you want even more. because it's like whetting your appetite for something. They don't have the full essence of God. They just have a dimension of God. So that kind of whets their appetite. It's almost like a teaser. So because they have something, that's why they have a burning desire for more. Someone who's clueless doesn't know what something is, and they don't even know, they don't even have the desire for it because they don't appreciate it. But once you appreciate it to some degree, right? If you go to the smorgasbord and you get a little piece of beef beforehand, and that's a teaser, then you want more. You want the main course. So this is what the angels are saying when they say kadosh. It's an expression of longing for more access or more revelation to be able to appreciate the divine presence even more than they have access to already. That's the meaning. And that's why they're called burned ones, because they have a burning desire for more. Yes, Kim?
Do people not have that same burning desire and want to get closer to God?
You're saying, do we?
Eve.
Did Eve have it?
That's what I'm saying. It's not part of her motivation.
For eating from the tree? Depends on what level. I mean, most certainly they had, they before the sin, they like lived in the Garden of Eden. So they did have a very, you could say they had a full serving of godliness. So yes, once you have, you want more. Did she think she was going to find it in the tree? It could be. Maybe there's some Kabbalistic twist to it that I'm not familiar with.
I've heard that before from a rabbi. I was just wondering.
Okay, well, I'm sure it was a worthy rabbi or Rebbetzin, if that's the case. I'm sure it's correct. But yes, there's definitely something to it on a deeper level, beyond the literal. Yes?
So you say that there are three categories of angels, at least. How do you say Beibrit angel? What is the word?
Malach.
And what is the verb with that shortage, for example?
What does the word malach?
For example.
It means angel.
It's okay, but you know, in Hebrew, if you have a substantive, you can create the adjective of the verb, right? Like talmid, lamed, lomet. So with that substantive, what would be a verb for an angel? I'm trying to understand what angel means, right? Can you give me more context?
The term in Hebrew is also used for messenger, as somebody noted.
So they are messengers.
Right. In fact, in the Torah earlier, which we read last week, it uses the term. And over there, it does mean angels. But in 2 weeks from now, we're going to read Vayishlach, where you also have the term malachim in plural. But over there, it actually means messengers, human messengers.
And that was my next question. That was a stupid one, but I think that it's not very stupid since you said human. I was asking you, are angels considered humans?
They're not.
So why do they call it human?
That's a good question. That's why Rashi, the commentator, has to tell us right there. He says, here we mean human messengers. We don't mean angels.
So by saying that, he neglects the fact that they are humans. Correct?
Correct. Because angel usually will mean not a human. Okay. Now, an angel could come and could be disguised as a human.
Yeah.
But they're really an angel. They're really not a human. They're just taking on that form. Right?
So was it angels that came to Adam, or was it God disguised?
It was angels. Angels disguised as humans. That's why they, when he served them food, they didn't really need to eat because they were angels. But you're supposed to kind of go along when you visit somewhere. You're supposed to behave according to the code of conduct in that location. So they went along with it and they made believe they were eating. I don't want to get carried away, but a human angel. I mean, people have encountered angels. We don't. It's a little. I don't think I have. At least not knowing, but we don't always know who is what, right? There may be angels sitting here at these tables. I'm sure there are, you know, as you said, your children. There's many that I know too. But just in very short, there was somebody that tells a story that he was online. Not to bring up sad history, but he was online at Auschwitz before the selection. And it was based on your age. of which direction you would be sent. So there was this young teenager, maybe, I don't know, maybe 13, 14 years old. And again, I'm not even sure myself but what the cutoff meant, or I don't know if there was, you know, if it was black and white, maybe it was age, and also the way, if somebody looked capable or not, I don't know. But anyway, he tells a story that somebody, while he was online, he was approached, and somebody who maybe knew him and knew his age, wanted his age to be different, maybe older. And he whispered in his ear, "Your birthday is X, Y, and Z," and told him a date and a year of when your birthday is. And this, he said, I heard someone whisper it in my ear. I turned around, and I couldn't even see who it was. But moments later, he was asked his age, and he responded based on the message that he was just whispered in his ear, and his life was spared. So, angels are angels. Was it somebody who was online that knew him? Very possible. I don't know. But he couldn't identify who it was. So, yes, angels could take on human form, but essentially they remain. An angel is like a soul without a body, in essence. But we're not going to really get heavily into it right now, because it's not the whole topic today. We just needed this topic to clarify a specific idea. And that is, so I think we kind of brought home the idea already, but just to go back to the Einstein or Newton, whichever one you like better, when he conveys an idea, when he distills an idea from his big theories and communicates it to a teenager. So if the teenager is a smart young fellow and he understands the idea, what's going to happen next? He's going to follow this teacher out of the classroom, and he's going to say, I want more. I was fascinated by what you said. Can you tell me more? And eventually he may come to understand the full-on idea that Einstein has, that he only shared a distillation from it in the classroom. But once somebody experienced that, it kind of teases them, and now they want more. That, it's like there's when you hear something from somebody, okay, you can hear what they said, but now you're kind of like, now I want to get to know you. I heard what you know. I heard this idea from you. Now I want to get to know you. And that is like what the attitude of the angels are, especially in this world of Bria. And that's why they recite this verse, and that's why angels have wings. Why do they have wings? Because they aspire. They're longing and yearning to connect with a deeper dimension of godliness than that they have access to just by default. And finally, why do we say this prayer? Why do we say the prayer? For the same reason. Anyone know what we do when we say the words Kadosh?
Raise
you raise your heel. What are we doing? But now it makes sense, doesn't it? We're actually lifting ourselves up. It's expressing that sense of longing and aspiration to connect with something beyond ourselves. Just like the angels are trying to achieve with their wings, and by reciting this, we are, so to speak, doing, you know, mimicking them, but we aspire to the same thing. We're trying to connect with something higher and deeper and greater than what we have. So, and just one more point on this is to bring it home a drop more. It's like if you go to some art museum and you see a beautiful, stunning piece of art, and now you're like, now I want to meet the artist. You kind of want to see what's beyond this. You want to get to know the author after you read the book. And that is what this is like, wanting to connect with a deeper level of godliness beyond what you experienced thus far. So we talked about all this. And just to bring home this point, seeing God as the creator should be a bridge to appreciating him for who he is. So we're kind of introduced to God from seeing how he acts within creation. All of our awareness of God starts here in this world. And this is where we are. This is what we see. This is our experience. And this is how we are introduced to God from creation. But once we kind of see him within creation, that should be triggering our interest and a deeper longing to want to discover more than what we have within creation. This is what the infinite light is, God beyond creation, what we're trying to get to. Am I making sense? All good? Okay. So now that we appreciated one verse in our prayers that was familiar to us, but now we have a deeper understanding of it, let's do that to another well-known prayer. Anyone know this one? Oh, Hoseh Shalom Bimromav, right? Text number 6 on page 82 in your book. On 82, what does it say? May he who makes peace in his heavens make peace for us in all of Israel and say Amen. What exactly is happening here? We understand that we need to pray for peace. And sometimes more than other times, but that we can relate to. What does it mean, he who makes peace in his heavens? Who exactly is in a fight with who in heaven? Anyone? So, what's the idea? What are the factions like exactly over there? So everyone wants to reach something higher than what they have, but they're not fighting. That's actually a very peaceful way. If everyone just moves up a notch, everyone clears space for the next one. Where exactly is the fight? So last week we spoke about the ten emanations or sephirot within the world of Atzilut, which is a step up from the angels. By the way, our souls originate in the world of Atzilut, which is beyond the angels, but that's beyond the scope of right now. So we spoke about those ten faculties in the soul, energies that emanate from God, and we kind of honed in on three of them, if you recall. Chesed, which was kindness. Anyone remember? And what was the opposing?
Gevura.
So we had Chesed, which was like on the right side, and Gevura on the left. Chesed represented kindness. We talked about someone who doesn't know how to say no to anybody. They just give and give and give, sometimes even to the detriment of the recipient. But they just know how to give. Then you have a gevura type, which is more disciplined. Basically, it could come to a situation where chesed will say, give. Gevura will say, the same person, no, don't give him. It could be a child with a knife. It could be an alcohol for an addict or whatever, something that's unhealthy where that person shouldn't be getting it. But Chesed doesn't see that. They just see giving, always. So what could happen here? What's the risk here? The risk is that in heaven, where you have Chesed in the world of Atzilut, which we're speaking in the divine realm right now, not within ourselves, Chesed is a very powerful force. Gevura is also a powerful force. So in the spiritual world of Atzilut, again, and that's what we discussed last week, there is a risk of these two opposing forces like having a fight. I think we even talked about one representing water, one representing fire. These two don't mix. It's either you or me. So these emanations have big personalities, whether it's Chesed or Gevura. They're intense, and they represent something, and they have definition, and they're very specific. If that's the case, it could lead to intolerance of the other, right? Sure, you are all familiar, and you see this playing out, whether it's in the corporate world or in any type of circumstance, where you have two people who have a personality clash, and it's either. You or me, we both can't continue working in this environment. It's just not going to work. It's one or the other. So this is where you have, where you could have these, so to speak, these fights breaking out in heaven, because you have these two intense powers, which are possibly opposing each other. So because of that, Because of this, by the way, you may want to look at your map. You see some of you have it out already. So last week we talked about these emotions. The first three are intellectual, which we'll actually try to come back to tonight. But right now we're talking about chesed and gevura. These are, they represent two opposing emotions or expressions. And then we have tiferet, which kind of is the fusion of both. But we're not getting to that yet. Right now, chesed and gevura, they oppose each other. So each sefira embraces its definition. So let's see what happens now. And this is where we'll get a dose of Kabbalah, and we'll read text number 7, and we'll come to understand how this fight that's breaking out in heaven between chesed and gevura, how do we resolve it? How do we reconcile it? So we're actually going to give a parable of, let's say, two ministers that have important positions before in the king's palace. One oversees the economy, and the other oversees the military. The military guy wants to grow the military, but the economy guy is going to say, well, we can't do that right now because it's going to compromise the economy. And you have these two opposing views. Now, what do? They go to the king to reconcile it. Once these two opposing ministers each have their own character, their own definition, and their own role, very strong, each in their own right. But when they come before the king and the king speaks, then the rigidity of their characters is kind of calmed. In the presence of the king, then they kind of they're mellowed. The intensity of each of their personality becomes more mellow. And the presence of the king, who transcends both of them, makes it possible for the two of them to coexist, even though they have their roles. But when they come before the king, they both appreciate that the king transcends them both, and that allows the two of them to be able to coexist and to relax and take the edge off of their intensity removed from their personality. Let's read it straight from the source in text number 7. Where were we? Bernard, do you want to read for us, please, on 83, text number 7.
Sensing this supernatural light, the separate experience by Bichel, they relinquish their configuration and synthesize with each other. Consider the example of two government ministries who hopelessly oppose each other. When they must appear together before the king, they remain. With their preferences, but find themselves working with the opposing viewpoints to reach required consensus. This is a consequence of their state of vital that results from their overwhelming reputation and awe of the king's magistry, whose rank by far transcends their own. Similarly, the opposite force of lust and covert and
Atzilut
can sympathize due to the illumination of God's infinite light.
Wonderful, thank you. So what did we say here? We gave this parable, and this is from Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, author of the Tanya, and he's the one that gives this parable of these two ministers, each with a very strong personality, but in the king's presence, it's diminished, and they experience bitul. Bitul means like self-nullification. Their own character and personality is relaxed a little bit so they can tolerate each other. Similarly, when we talk about making peace in heaven, what's exactly playing out? So you have these two opposing powers within the world of Atzilut. Now they're both emanations from God. Don't misunderstand here. There's God the way he expresses kindness, God the way he behaves more discipline, where he practices restraint. But these two forces could be opposing each other. How do they coexist? How do both of them function? That's because they are both present before the king. Who's the king in this discussion? Of course, we know it's God, but which component of God? That is the infinite light. Because the light of Chesed, the energy of Chesed, has definition. It's an emanation. Gevura is a defined emanation. That is God when he is practicing restraint or discipline or strictness, etc., as opposed to kindness. So both of them are divine emanations. How do both of them coexist if each one is powerful in its own right? The reason why they can coexist is because there is something that transcends both of them, and that is the infinite light. Infinite light means the undefined light. Remember the black and white sheet? The white sheet, the backdrop, that's the infinite light. And that the presence of God in his infinity, that allows for these opposing factions, or potentially opposing factions, to keep everybody in check, so to speak. And everyone's behaving, and everyone's allowing for the other and leaving space for the other. Why is that possible? Because of the infinite light. If the infinite light wasn't there, God forbid, then there would be trouble. But because it is there, things are able to function properly. So you have God's infinity that makes it all possible. And just to advance this a little bit, when do we say this verse, this line? Oseh shalom bimromav. When do each of us say it in our prayers? Anybody?
The end of the Amidah.
We say it at the end of the Amidah, correct?
The end of the Kaddish.
Also at the end of Kaddish, but everybody says it at the end of the Amidah. Why do we say it at the end of the Amidah, first of all? Why are we suddenly looking for peace? Why do we need to nullify or remove the edge from our personality at the end of the Amidah? I mean, we just prayed. You would think that's not a time. That's a time of humility. That's not a time that we would need to, so to speak, humble ourselves. But the truth is the opposite. After praying, we may have developed what we may want to call a righteous sense of ego. You know, sometimes somebody religious could be really obnoxious, and they can give off this self-righteous aura, and as if they're holier than thou. I don't know, you know. All of us have experienced it at some point with somebody out there. Hopefully not in Houston. Very, very little here. But it's possible for it to happen. Because someone who just finished their prayers may have this inflated ego, not a coarseness of ego, but a sense of righteous ego. Like, wow, oh, I just had a great prayer. Right then is when we have to recite this prayer of Oseh Shalom Bimromav. Now, another important component is, before we actually recite these words of he who makes peace in his realm above, in his abode, should make peace here below, what do we actually do before we say those words?
Step back.
We take 3 steps back. Because in order to make peace, we have to create space and we have to withdraw. We have to remove our own inflated ego. We have to take a step back or 3 steps back. And then when both parties can do that, and realize that it's not just about me, but we create space for the other, then that's a recipe for peace.
You should send that lesson to Washington, D.C.
Well, if anybody's going tomorrow, they should take it with them. Well, hopefully they'll get the message. But, you know, we all think that the other needs to hear the message. Right? But yes, you're right. We should send it to Washington. Yes, it's like fire and water.
So it's
possible.
Like you're bad, you're good, you're evil, you know, you're not.
Look, it depends. There's when two people are trying to find a path forward and they're struggling to, then everything we're saying here certainly applies to that such a scenario. In a scenario where somebody is a manifestation of evil and perpetrated evil, they're beyond repair. Somebody who's a little bit more of in a neutral space and is being directed in a wrong direction, yes, maybe they could still be saved. And maybe they can go to JLI somewhere in their neighborhood, and they can study some Kabbalah, and there's certainly hope for them. But to look at evil in the face and say, well, maybe let's have a sane conversation about Kabbalah, that would be the wrong thing to do. Yes?
So you said that Or Ein Sof means infinite light.
Correct.
And that says there that it is Keter. But in the book says that Keter is crown.
We're getting there. Let's not jump ahead. One more thing before we actually come to the crown. And that one more thing is, we said we're going to talk about marriage, right? So anyone know how a Jewish marriage is performed? What are you standing under?
Chuppah.
A chuppah. Why are we standing under a chuppah? Why don't we just, you rented out a beautiful hall, just do it in the hall. What are you putting up this canopy for? Sometimes it's just a shmata. Who needs it? What does it represent? And that's the idea. It represents the infinite light. Why do we need the presence of the infinite light at a time of a marriage? Very simple. Because under that chuppah, under that infinite light, sometimes you have chesed and gvura. Not necessarily a full-on manifestation of each, but you have two different people. You have a male and female. See the world in different ways. They're designed differently. And right now, on the wedding day, the wedding day represents perfection. But a time may come, maybe a year, 3 years, 5 or 20 years, when things may not look as perfect as they did on that wedding day. Imperfection starts to take hold on the end of both parties. So what happens then? We have to fall back and remember that we entered into this relationship under a chuppah. We did so with the infinite light hovering above us. And it's only with the power of that infinite light that these two parties are able to stay in a relationship and function together. And just to throw in one more thing, at the end of a chuppah ceremony, what do? Last thing. We break the glass, and then what do we scream? Why are we breaking glass and screaming Mazel Tov? I mean, if you want to break glass, break glass. But why are you Mazel Toving over the break glass? So the breaked glass represents something broken, literally or figuratively. And it represents imperfection. Yes, the wedding night is perfect. But the breaking of the glass represents that a day may come where we will encounter imperfection. So what do we do? What's the pact and the covenant that we're entering into on that glorious day? It's that whenever we do encounter something broken, what's our attitude going to be? We're going to scream, Mazel Tov. We're going to be able to congratulate the fact that we are each imperfect. And at the marriage ceremony, why do we actually do it then? Because we're saying that we're not blinded by the fact that we think everything is going to be as perfect as it is today. There will be brokenness that will be encountered, but we are committing to each other that we're going to be able, that when we experience it, we'll just look at each other and say, Mazel Tov, we're imperfect. And now we have to come to terms with that and allow space for those imperfections in the other, but we embrace all of it, the perfection and the imperfection at the time of the marriage. How do we do that? Because we're standing under a chuppah, we have the infinite light that's present at the time of a wedding. And just for fun, and I know we are running late, but on page 86, you'll see a whole pattern. I'm not going to get into it in detail right now. I'm just going to identify all these infinite light representations at a marriage ceremony. It starts from the chuppah, which hovers from above, the veiling of the bride, the circling. The bride circles the groom, right? 7 times under the chuppah. That's also representative of that all-encompassing divine infinite light. And then we use a ring, a perfect ring with no blemishes or nothing on it. Again, it represents the infinite light. And finally, how do we dance at weddings? Usually in a circle, right? We do the hora. Why? Again, the circle throughout the whole wedding evening represents the fact that we are drawing down the infinite light of God, and that is what's going to leave its mark, not just on the night of their marriage, but on their future life together. Always making space for the other, and that's how they'll have a successful life together. Okay, let me just catch up here on the slides. Okay, we're going to come back to this shortly. Keter does mean crown. The Jewish wedding has a physical bond, but also a soul bond. How could two souls merge together as soulmates? So when it comes to physical objects, you can make something, but it could also come apart. And it could also come to an end. You can have something physical, but that physical thing can be gone. However, the presence of the infinite light in a marriage is actual. This is one area where humans also practice and actually adapt God's infinite capacity. And that is in bringing children into the world, because it's literally infinite. When a couple is blessed with a child, that child then grows up, gets married, and brings yet another child into the world. So that is literally the power of infinity, where humans partner with God and actually perpetuate humankind with that special infinite power that they possess. Okay, so I'm just going to catch up here, but we kind of discussed all of this already. All right, so I think we're in the right place now. Any quick question or comment before we advance to the last phase of tonight's discussion? It's either I made no sense at all, or I'm making a lot of sense. Which one?
I have a question.
Yes.
Going back to angels, does each person have, like, are they assigned their own angels, or how? I mean, like.
You may say so. Every time we do a mitzvah, we actually create an angel. Do you know that? Yes, every time we do a mitzvah, we create an angel. I don't know. I try to think positive. We're certainly not creating angels. Maybe some other things, but better not to think about it. So yes, the more mitzvahs we do, the more angels we have surrounding us and looking after us. I think that we can relate to it. There are certain people that everyone knows are the first to do mitzvahs, and just to be in their presence is a mechaya, right? Because they're probably accompanied by so many angels. We can all do that. All right? Okay. So, with the remaining time, as usual, especially in this course, usually the last 20 minutes, we pack in about 40 minutes of material. But hopefully you'll get whatever's necessary. So on our maps, we're kind of ready to move up, I believe, right? Let's see, where are we here? So we're going to advance. We're going to continue climbing upward and really trying to kind of bring this home. We've been talking about the infinite light, which is the undefined, which is the beyond the 10 sefirot in Atzilut. Infinite light is beyond that. In the parable of the professor, the infinite light is the mind of the professor. Not the idea that he conveyed to the teenager. That's like the emanations. That's Atzilut. The backdrop, the world of his own ideas and theories. That's like That's the infinite light. Of course, we're just using it as a way to wrap our minds around it to some degree, but obviously it's just human terms that we could relate to. So, what does infinite light represent within the human? We spoke last week that the 10 sefirot represent the 10 faculties that we each have. 3 intellectual, 7 emotional. Those are the 10. We saw it before. You could see it on your maps right over here. You see these 10, 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, 10. These are all the 10 sefirot of Atzilut. In our own world, the 3 are intellectual, which, by the way, we're still going to be discussing tonight, and then the 7 emotional. But where's the infinite light? Infinite light can't be any of these 10, because these 10 are not infinite. They're finite. They're specific emanations. They have definition. Infinite light has to be, think of like the chuppah that hovers from above. It can't be one of the two parties. It has to be something beyond that transcends. And this is where we go upward and we move up to the yellow area. In fact, I should be looking at the right side, which is the human. This is within the divine worlds. On this side of the map, it represents in the divine image the human soul. So again, it's that yellow dot. That's where the infinite light is. And over here, we're calling it pleasure and desire. We're not going to be talking about pleasure tonight. We're going to be talking about desire tonight. And that's in that yellow area, which, by the way, is also called Keter, because a crown hovers from above. That's what the infinite light is. It hovers, right? Yeah? Okay. So let's talk about desire for a little bit. Let's talk about desire a little bit. And that is like this. When somebody wants to do something, then you can have various different levels of capabilities, let's say. Someone needs to get something done. But doing that thing, you can have different people that maybe want to do the same thing, but one is maybe has stronger skills to get it done, the other one less so. You may even have two people, two students in the same class, and one has, let's just say, more developed, better skills to succeed in the classroom, the other fellow less so. But here's the question. If the one with weaker skills has a stronger willpower, and the one with stronger skills has a weaker willpower, which one of the two will do better? The one who has a stronger desire and a stronger willpower could do better, even though their skills may not be to the same level as the fellow sitting next to them, but has a lack of interest or doesn't have the desire and will to succeed. This is where will and desire comes into the picture. It stands above the specific faculties, and that's because it drives all of them. Our sages tell us, Ein lach davar ha'omeid bifnei haratzon. There is nothing that could stand in the front of somebody's willpower. If somebody has the will to succeed, and they really, really want to succeed, then nothing could get in their way. And they can succeed to a much greater degree than other people who have less talents than them, but are incomparable in their willpower. So within will, within desire, we're going to introduce two different types of desire. That's what we're going to do here. And before we actually read text 11, maybe I'll just give you a little bit of a synopsis that we have. We're going to introduce today two different types of desire. One we're going to call innate desire, or you can call it essential desire if you want. What does that mean? Those refer to things that somebody wants where we don't even have to think about it much in order to want it. Like, for example, the will to live. Did anybody here take a course on wanting to live and then come to the conclusion that, yes, you know what, it's a great idea, I really thought it through, I want to live? Nobody did. You know why? Because we don't need to. it's innate, it's essential to our being. Just the fact that we exist, we have a very deep desire to live. Okay, if you're blessed with a family or loved ones, you never needed to take a course on trying to develop your love for your family. Maybe you needed to take a course to develop to develop your ability to like your family, maybe. But to love your family, that's innate. Or to care for your family, or to care for your children, or children for parents. These things are innate and they're essential. It's not this course, but it doesn't mean that everyone always gets along. But we are saying that it does mean that we always have that deep relationship. You don't need to think about it. You don't need to contemplate loving your children. You just do. You don't think twice. That's all essential desire. But then you have other things that you want, not because you innately want those things, but because you develop a liking for those things. And maybe you are on the market for a new car. And you're doing some research, and you're going here, and you're going there. I personally stay away from car dealerships. I get headaches about 60 seconds after I get there. But whatever, if you need one, you need one. And you need to do the research, and maybe you've come to the conclusion that you want a particular car. How did you develop? How did you decide you want that car? You weren't born with it. You did your research, you studied it, you looked here, you tested it, you read this, that, or the other, and you came to the conclusion, that's the car I want. What if someone then tells you, actually, it does have these good qualities, but that car actually has a deficiency. So your will could change. You can suddenly become disinterested in that car, even though you wanted it 5 minutes ago. Why? Because that's not innate desire. That is what we're going to call created desire. There are things that I develop a liking for or create the desire for it because I researched, I studied, I got information, and then came to that conclusion. So that's the difference here. So the thing is like this. When it comes to human desire, as we said before, its desire is really powerful. Willpower is very powerful. It's big, it's bold, it's intense. And like I said, when somebody does want something, when someone wants something, it actually, the willpower, look right here. When you have the desire for something, then you could drive all of your other faculties, you could drive them meshuggah with your willpower. And you're going to, once you want something, then you'll find ways to make sense of it intellectually, and eventually you'll develop feelings for it, and eventually you'll get that thing done. And what's driving it, what's fueling everything? It's all the willpower. Because you decided you want something. I'm sure everybody here could relate to this. Sometimes, or if not you, then your child may have driven you crazy at some point that they want something, and you can't convince them out of it. They just want it. And when you want it, then everything else follows. If somebody has a strong willpower, they drive and fuel everything else. That's why it's above. That's why it's the crown. That's why it's on top of everything. Because it actually has the power to drive everything else. Intellect is powerful, but you can also undo it. As we just said, you can hear an idea that was opposing what you thought, and you'll have to change your way of thinking. If it calls into question what you thought till now. And the same is with an emotion. But when you have willpower driving everything, then it could just mow everything down until you actually get what you want. But there's good news here. There is good news here. And that is, should we read that text? I think I kind of conveyed it already orally, maybe on your own time. I would encourage you to read any of the texts that we did not read together. So these are the two categories, right? Did I make sense? Yeah? Okay, let's just maybe utilize this over here for a moment. So the word ratzon in Hebrew actually has the same letters as the word tzinor. What does it mean? Ratzon means will and desire. Tzinur is a conduit or pipeline. Same letters. That's because willpower is like the conduit, because it starts from the top and it drives everything, and it kind of moves through the pipeline and gets whatever you need it to get done, gets done. So we talked about the innate desire, which is beyond intellect, and it actually sways intellect. When you want something, then your mind will bend itself and accommodate your willpower. It's going to start making sense to you if it hasn't yet. And it's constant, and it's infinity-like, because it drives everything. Like we described before, it represents the infinite light within the human, represents the willpower, because the willpower is just raw. But once you want something, then it drives everything. And that is true when it comes to... So we talked about the two levels of desire. The higher is kind of like the innate or the essential, and that desire drives the logic. But then you have the lower desire, which is created by logic, as we said before. You can explore or research something, and then you'll end up wanting it. That's where logic drives the desire. But it's possible also to start from the lower desire and kind of come to a conclusion based on your calculations, and then it kind of makes sense to you, then you can trigger your real innate desire, and with that, with the help of your innate essential desire, you then could add a whole new dose of intensity to that desire and get it done, even though it may have been initiated by logic. So, let's advance a little bit more. I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you have somebody, and I meet people like this all the time, and they tell me, you know what, Rabbi, people have told me before, you know, they're already middle-aged, they say, if I was just starting my life now, I think I would do it more like the way you did it. But that's not the point. The point is that they say, well, I didn't have a Jewish education, I didn't go to a Jewish day school, and many will say, well, I'm just, I missed the boat. Some people may come to that conclusion. And it's a wrong conclusion, because there are many people who may be middle-aged or at whatever point, they decide, you know what, maybe I didn't have it when I was younger, but I want to achieve it now. And they have a very strong willpower to change things. And I've met many, many people like this in my years here in Houston. And there are people who are, they're different people to the way they are now from when I met them. When I met them, they were like, you know, an adult, but they were like that child who didn't have the education. And then they decided to turn things around, and they put in the work. And when you put in the work, driven by the desire, the will to change things, and you put in the work day in and day out, and year after year, eventually, you can be a different person. And people like this, who I meet all the time, are extremely inspiring people. But how did it all start? It started because they had the will and the desire to change things. Whatever was, okay, that was my circumstance, that's where I grew up, that's what I had access to, that's what I didn't have access to. We can't change the past. But with the willpower and the desire to change the future, we absolutely can, and we could successfully do so if we really, really want to. And if you really want to, we absolutely can. And there's an incredible story, actually. We're not going to read it because it's a little long. In text number 14, on this idea, there's actually a name to the story. In Chabad history, a fellow by the name of Yekusiel of Liepler, from Liepli. And he actually was very much an ignoramus. He wasn't even capable of studying. And he, I don't know if it says his age, but he certainly was an adult. I don't know if he was in his 30s, 40s, or 50s, but he literally decided he wants to change things, and he literally put in deep intellectual work for months, literally months, with his teacher, and he became a tremendous master. Specifically in Hasidic philosophy and Kabbalah, to the extent that one of the Rebbes wrote a book and his primary address or student who he wrote the book for was this student who was incapable of even reading a few years earlier. And by the way, you know Rabbi Akiva, the great sage of the Mishnah? Is that what you were just saying?
Yeah.
Rabbi Akiva didn't know the letters of the alphabet till he was 40 years old. And he was actually walking, and he saw that there was a drip drop of water, one drop at a time, landing on a rock. And he saw that in the spot where the water was dripping, there was actually a dent in the rock.
Well, that's because he wanted a woman.
Well, that was... it was a different part of the story. He actually went to study with her permission. But that, if it was just a woman, then he wouldn't have to have encountered this. It was this that proved to him that he actually could do it. When he saw that the drops of water making a dent even in a rock, he said that most certainly the water, which is compared to Torah, represents wisdom. If I start applying myself and start studying, it will make a dent in me. And he started to study at age 40, and you could find his name in every other page of the Talmud, which is a very important lesson to all of us, that if we want to, we can achieve it. We have another story here, which we will read. It's a very powerful one. Nanette, I think we're up to you. By the way, if someone doesn't want to read, just say so. If you're okay, Nanette, on page 99, text number 15, please read that in English. I believe, I don't speak the language, but it says Mojic. Mojic da nie chocic.
Which means you can, but you don't want. In other words, you have the ability, but not the will. And without the will, you imagine that it is too much for you. Afterward, the Baal Shem Tov explained to his students that what they heard was not a coincidence, but a lesson for serving God. When Jewish children set out to study Torah, and the same is true of Jewish adults, they may feel that they are unable to do so due to fatigue. They need to remember, God gives us the strength to do all good things. It is just that we sometimes listen to the voice of the negative inclination within us, and then lose the desire to act accordingly. At that point, we falsely believe that we are incapable.
Thank you very much. First of all, Zalina, are those words accurate?
Yes, yes.
So how would you say it?
So
Mojish means you can, yeah, but you don't want to.
Yeah, but you don't want to.
But the da means yes, so that's part of the Mojish, right?
Da ni chochish, that means, but you don't want.
That sense does,
yeah.
Okay, so it's not the yes, it's part of the but you don't want to. So you can, he said. You can help me get my wagon out of the mud, but you don't want to. After that fellow left the study hall, the teacher, the Baal Shem Tov, turned to the students and said that this is a very powerful lesson in life, that often things come our way, and we say, well, we can't. The truth is we could, but we don't want to. The moment we decide that we want to, then we'll be able to succeed in it. Thank you for the reading, and thank you, Zelina, for the Ukrainian assistance there. One more big idea that we're going to close with in the next, just for the next couple minutes. So on your map, you may remember that it's really associated with last week's discussion, because it's within the world of Atzilut. But the question really is, it's very nice that we're saying if somebody wants to do something, as long as you want to, you can do it. Okay, but what if I don't have the desire to do it? What if there's something that I would love to see myself get involved in it and achieve a certain goal, but I just don't have the will right now? I don't have the desire. What could we do then? What type of solution is there if we need to actually develop the desire itself? So for that, we're just going to look for a moment at the three highest of the 10 faculties here that we discussed last week. So we didn't focus on the intellectual ones last week. We focused on the emotional ones, chesed, gevura, tiferet. Those are emotional. We did not focus on the intellectual, which, who knows what Chabad stands for?
Chochma bina dat.
Just so happens to be. Different discussion. What does it mean? So, I'm just going to advance here a little bit. Right here. So, Chachma Bina Dat are the three intellectual powers that we find within Atzilut, within God. And those are the first three of the 10 emanations. I know we keep going back from last week to this week. Atzilut, infinite light, back down. But that's the nature of Kabbalah. It's all going to start making sense. I hope it already is. So the first three, within those three, the first of the three is Chachma. We're not going to dwell on the two because I want to get to the third. But Chachma is like, represents a flash of inspiration. You may have been trying once to think of an idea, and suddenly you get a flash of inspiration. You can't yet explain it. You didn't develop the idea yet, but you just know, I got it. That's what Chachma represents. And the actual words Chachma, if you break it up, it says Koach Ma, which means like what is this? Koach means potential. Ma means what? Like, what is this? Because at the stage of the flash of inspiration, you don't yet even know what it is. It's something, but you don't know what it is yet. Now, in other words, it's just a seed. Then you have to take that seed and bring it to fruition. You have to develop it. And that's what Bina is. Bina literally means comprehension, but that's the power within the earth bringing seed to fruition. And that's when you take an idea or a seed in the ground, and or an idea which you then take and develop it and properly meditate on it and then understand it. But then that brings you to the third, which is called Dat. Literally, again, it means knowledge. But over here, in this discussion, it means something else. Not just knowledge. Knowing doesn't just mean to have information. Knowing means to connect deeply with an idea. When I'm in the earlier phase of Bina, I also know the information. So what's the difference between Bina and Dat, if in both I'm knowing? The answer is that in Dat, it's not just about knowing. It's not just about having information. It's about integrating that information.
Insight,
but beyond insight. It's making it personal. You're personalizing the information. Once students of Aristotle saw him doing something immoral, and they said to him, "You're our teacher, you're Aristotle, how can you do such a thing?" It's contrary to things that he taught them. He said, "Right now I'm not Aristotle." In other words, the information he had, he even taught the information, but it wasn't integrated. He was able to act contrary to the very information that he had and taught others. Why? Because it didn't become who he is. It was never integrated. It was just information. That means Chachma and Bina. Once you have that, that means it became part of you. It's not just what you know, it's what you are. That's the difference. And when we struggle to develop a will and desire for something, the key component here is das, which means that when you know something, you have to actually know it, which means you have to become one with it. And actually, it says in Genesis, it's in the next text, it's in text number 16a, I'll actually just read it because it's a short one. In 16a, dat consists of a familiar connection that triggers desire. Thus, the Torah uses the term dat to depict a bond. As in the verse, Adam knew Eve. Did you know this? In Genesis, it says, Adam knew Eve, and Eve became pregnant. How does that work? Just because he knew her? No, because it doesn't just mean he knew her. It means an intimate bond. Knowing means that you connect deeply with something. And that's what it means throughout. And that's what dat means. It means a close, integrated connection with the information.
Can you say dat with the Torah?
Could you say dat with Torah? You have to say dat with Torah. Every Torah idea that we learn can't just stay chachma and bina. It has to become dat. Otherwise, we're like Aristotle. We could study information, have a lot of ideas, but it has nothing to do with us. It's just it's just information. I'm going to use this story, which is very well known in Chabad circles, to bring home this point. And that is, the story is about a farmer. And this farmer, although he was a successful farmer, he was very illiterate. And he wasn't even able to read. So he had a teacher. He hired a teacher who taught his children and maybe others on the farm. And his job wasn't only to teach and educate the children, but in fact, once a week, they would, all the mail that would come in, once a week, they would call the teacher. This farmer would ask the teacher to come and open his mail and read letters that he got for him. Again, he wasn't able to read himself. Wonderful guy, but he was illiterate. So one given day, he's reading a letter. The teacher is reading a letter for the farmer. It was addressed to the farmer, and he's reading it for him. As he's reading, he comes across the unfortunate news that the farmer's father had passed away. This is what he's reading in the letter to the farmer. The farmer hears it, and he faints on the spot. And the question is, if that teacher was reading the letter for the farmer, even if you want to tell me that the farmer should also faint, but shouldn't the guy reading the letter first and foremost faint? He's the one reading it. Why didn't he faint?
There's no connection.
Because there's no dot. It's not his father. The farmer is the one that fainted because it's his father. It's his information. It's not just an abstract idea for him. It's not just a letter that he's reading. He's not delivering information to someone else. It's his own. And because it's his own, that's how he reacted. And this is a key idea when it comes to everything in life, especially when it comes to Torah study, to anything related to Judaism. It's important that we never stop just at Chachma and Bina. It's not just about information. It's always about making it personal and applying it to ourselves. And when we do so, then we actually are able to create that desire, to create that willpower within ourselves. Why? Because anything that we encounter, anything that we take in, we're always asking ourselves, what does this mean to me? And you can have, you know, it's a very real thing nowadays, especially where we're all connected to Israel in one way or another, and we're all plugged into what's going on there. But sometimes, I mean, it's hard to say that someone, I'm not going to get into this heavily. There's a lot, obviously, a lot that we can discuss about this. But I just want to make one point quickly. And that is that sometimes, I mean, I'm sure everybody here, when you hear something that's going on there now, you take it very personally. There's a lot of dot involved. We take it very personal and we feel for it. It's not just information. There's this one political pundit or political commentator who I'm not going to name because I'm sure everybody has very strong opinions about her. So I just gave it away a little bit. But everyone's wondering why she isn't speaking out against the atrocities that happened in Israel. And she's been explaining lately that she's not Jewish, so I just don't have strong feelings about it to take a side. I'm not taking a side because I'm not Jewish, so I don't have those strong feelings. Now, obviously, you could argue and you should argue that any decent human being, when you see what's going on, you can't not take a side if you have just a healthy conscience. But that's not the point right now. The point is that two people could be looking at the same thing. One takes it personally, the other doesn't, because the one that does has dat, because it's they care. When you care, then it actually means something totally different. So in conclusion of tonight's discussion, and we'll have a little roundup, a two-minute roundup on video, so we'll kind of bring all the ideas together. But the final point I want to just come back to is that when someone faces difficulties or a challenging road in front of them, when they want to achieve something, whether it's them or a loved one, Today's lesson teaches us that nothing stands in the way of a true desire. So all we need to do is really want to, but it's not enough. You can't just want to. After wanting to, we have to be willing to put in the work. But if we're willing to put in the work, and that work is being driven by willpower, then we could succeed with flying colors at anything we put our mind to. Thank you for joining lesson 3. We'll just zoom ahead to the video, and we will close out tonight's discussion.
Lesson 3, the infinite light. 1. In many prayers, we acknowledge God as the creator and develop a sense of closeness with him. At the same time, our daily prayers include passages that emphasize God's transcendence, for this aspect of God similarly deserves our attention. 2. Couples can set aside their differences by learning from their souls who were able to become soulmates by sensing God's infinity. Couples can then embrace their personalities and experiences and nevertheless find harmony. 3. Success requires strong desire. Therefore, we are advised to study those areas of Torah in which we already possess an interest. 4. We can generate desire by utilizing our power of dot connection to contemplate the importance of a given behavior or quality in a personalized way. 5. Our souls possess an innate desire to cleave to God. If this desire is concealed, we can awaken it by generating a calculated desire for God.